This episode of the podcast is brought to you by the Spotlight Project. The Spotlight Project is an amazing organization with the mission of raising employment for individuals with intellectual or developmental disabilities. Spotlight creates and sells beautiful jewelry, and each person they employ has an intellectual or developmental disability and a unique story to tell. You can give them a visit at thespotlightprojectco.com. Again, that's thespotlightprojectco.com. And use the coupon code HOPE, H-O-P-E, for 15% off your purchase.
Okay, so I'm Ramesh Nagaraja. I'm from Boston, Massachusetts. I grew up in the city in Roxbury to two parents in a multicultural household. My dad's from Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. And my mom is from Boston, actually grew up for many years in the house that we grew up in. And, you know, it was cool growing up in that household. I have two siblings, an older brother named Viraj. He's 25. He went to Bowdoin College, played football there, and works in tech based out of Boston.
Yep.
My little sister's 20. She goes to Gettysburg College. She's also a political science major, and I think she also does something with religious studies. And you know, we all were in the MECO program growing up, which anyone local to Boston knows is it's a voluntary integration program that started in the late 60s after or during the civil rights movement and has been running ever since, busing inner city kids, mostly minorities, to suburban schools with the hope of, on one side, improving the diversity in those schools and also giving a better educational opportunity to the city students. So from there, I started in Weston when I was 3, went through it all the way until I was 18.
Wow.
And went on to the Naval Academy. Always wanted to go there, and I just graduated and am now a Marine Corps officer, headed to grad school at Carnegie Mellon. And I have my degree in political science with honors from the Academy.
That's really exciting. Congratulations, I'm interrupting you. For the Naval Academy, you knew you always wanted to go there. What drew you to it?
I think as a young kid, I never really grew out of the little boys think soldiers are cool thing.
Yeah.
And in fifth grade, my cousin was a Marine. Okay. And I remember, you know, seeing him in the uniform, and just, we were always the cousins that people compared. You're like Daniel.
Yeah.
And I was like, I want to be a Marine Corps officer. And, you know, I always knew I wanted to go to school. So, you know, what's the best path to do that is to go to the Naval Academy. So thankfully I got some good advice when I was in around eighth grade and knew to start early on that process and to be prepared. Okay. And all the chips sort of fell into place and I ended up there.
That's awesome.
Never really went through the searching for what college I want to go to when like junior year hit. But
yeah, a painful time for many. And then what drew you to political science as a major?
So I actually started as an economics major for a semester.
Yeah.
Because the Academy has groups for the majors, group one, group two, and group three. And there's like kind of like a shade thrown on group three majors, which is like your humanities.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to be a group two major. So I went with what's called quantitative economics. And then, you know, I didn't like it. You know, I was good at it and I was doing well in the course load, but I wasn't excited by just learning really how money works and how it moves around in these systems. And I was already drawn to political science, but didn't go with it, even though, you know, I knew one day I probably wanted to get into politics or maybe go to law school. And like, of the majors at the Academy, that's probably most fitting for either of those tasks.
Okay.
And then I was just like, you know what, like I should be doing something that I really enjoy. And in a course load that I'm already spending most of my free time reading things like articles or podcasts, like that apply to this sphere, not economics. So I made the switch and then, you know, I loved it. I did really well in the major, you know, the honor society and, you know, ultimately wrote a thesis. And
oh, wow.
I enjoyed it a lot because the professors within the department are all really knowledgeable and passionate about what they do, which I think is true within every major, but, you know, our interests overlapped in this area.
Right.
Had a great time with it. Some great people in the major, and
yeah,
some academic courses that really grew my thinking.
And what was your thesis on?
I did my thesis on the Black church and politics and how size relates to that activity. So I wanted to do something that connected to the Black community, and I specifically dove into always knowing that the church was a major vehicle for politics in the Black community, especially like looking at the civil rights movement. Yeah. But a lot of research nowadays was sort of lacking and, you know, inconclusive about whether that relationship still exists. And I was really curious with how mega churches are really big, that's kind of a pun, but really big thing now and growing. And you have these massive churches where a lot of the members aren't from the community the church exists in. Okay. And you don't have this personal relationship with your pastor or the leadership within the church. Huh. And I was like, I wonder how things like that have affected whether or not it's still a serious vehicle within the Black community for engaging in politics.
And what did you find?
So it's still much more influential in the Black community than in the general community of churches.
Okay.
And it's also certain things like Souls to the Polls, which is like one of the more common things people know Black churches for, like certain behaviors, because I looked at a multitude of behaviors, certain behaviors like that are still extremely popular within the Black church and not always popular across generally churches, and very positively linked with size. And size just kind of allows a church to, I think it, I would dive more deeply into this if I could. And, yeah. You know, I like to say I didn't do my best work with my thesis because I got a little caught up with everything else in school. But
that's fair.
But like the financial resources and everything that, and just the ability to reach more people in a mega church or a large church,
yeah,
usually creates more positively with them taking on a scope that's bigger than just religion.
Right, right. And that, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And you mentioned in your Medium article that religion has been important to you. You know, growing up, you had a strong church community, I believe you said. Was it a large church? Do you feel like that influence was there for you in the political realm, or?
Well, I think I went to a decently sized church, about 300 members maybe.
Okay.
Which in Boston, I guess, is on the larger side, but
yeah,
you know, nothing like when you get to like down south or even where I am now, where they have these churches with 5,000 members and it's like there's another one across the street.
Wow.
So for me, I would say it was more my church life deeply influenced like my value set.
Okay.
Which I think then translates over to the way you see policies and what's important and, you know, charity or looking out for other people. And
yep.
I think that really influences, you know, the view you take on a lot of like welfare politics or things like that.
Yeah.
Which are like these hot topics, or like abortion, for instance, or LGBTQ, and like how you form those views and how they then develop and grow and change all stems from there. And then, you know, my church was a huge part of why I was in Mecco, because there were a lot of Mecco families in that. And if you know Mecco families, like your chances of getting into the Mecco program are a lot higher, just like who you connect with.
Right.
And
your network.
The reason why there were so many families within the church, this one church of many in Boston, like the ton of Mecco students came from. And I think there's like an educational value, or like the specific community I was in at this church. I think there were a lot of families that really valued education higher than what I saw generally across the community, and had kids who I watched grow up and become Division I athletes or Ivy League students. Wow. Or doctors by the time they're like 27. Like, wow. I was seeing stuff like that, which I think was rare to see in the community I was in.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then you see that and you want to model yourself after that individual.
Yeah.
And it's a positive feedback loop.
So I guess I should probably start in why I wrote the article and sort of what,
yeah,
the motivation behind all that. So obviously all these discussions were starting in the wake of George Floyd's death. And I think actually before that with Ahmaud Arbery, and just sort of, I think we were all in a very unique place because of the virus and being home and all just generally being reflective and reading more probably and being more in tune with what's going on in the world. And I think it was a very unique time where these issues really picked up a lot of steam really quickly. And, you know, I'm a guy who likes to discuss important things with my friends. And like, I'm the guy who's having like a deep conversation with someone in the middle of a party sometimes. Yeah. Like I'm that guy, and like my friends know that. And for that reason, you know, I had a lot of friends coming to me to talk about these issues, and you know, I wanted to be able to offer some insight. But I like to take the perspective of, like, I try to listen early on when these things are happening, and like read and let my thoughts build up, and I'll start a new note on my phone and just like add a thought add a thought at a random time, and then I'll sit down, and I've always appreciated writing. I just find it cathartic.
Totally. And like
it really organizes my thoughts succinctly, and like I can speak well, but I think I can write better.
Mm-hmm.
So I sat down one night and I just put all the thoughts down on paper within like 4 hours, sent it to my buddy to edit, and then within a few hours I posted this article. And you know, my perspective on it was, I thought there was a piece of the conversation that was missing.
Okay.
Which is, you know, obviously there's so much anger, rightfully, and all these feelings rightfully on display. But I thought there was like a very unique lens that a person who's very close with the white community, but affected personally by these issues and has skin in the game, for them to give a perspective, I think would connect better with a lot of, frankly, in my experience, a lot of good white people who just maybe don't understand where they play a role in this, or how they can be better, or what things they've seen and maybe never recognized.
Right.
And then on top of that, how much of it was like, have I just been assuming that they know these things, when the truth is I maybe never talked to them about it?
Yep.
Because like, to me, these things are like obvious, but
so obvious, yeah.
Within your own sphere and bubble and perspective, like, you just know what you know and how you were raised and what you see in life, and which, if we're doubling down on all these conversations, it's like, that's going to be a reflection of a privilege that you don't even realize you have, which is probably the hardest privilege to talk about.
Right.
So I wrote the piece expecting it to really just reach, you know, my friends and then their circle of friends with, like, you know, the power of a one-click share.
Yeah.
You know, and then suddenly within, you know, 2 days, it's
everywhere.
It's like everywhere, and it's like spreading like wildfire. You know, by the end of like up to now, it's like 2.5 million views on Medium, and like they made me a partner, and I've had calls all the time. You know, that first couple of weeks, I couldn't even be on my phone. I would have to cut out like 5 to 7 hours a day every 2 days or so to just go through all my messages and respond to various platforms. And I got like this first taste ever of like, wow, this is like what it would feel like to be someone who's like writing influentially or podcasting influentially. Like,
right.
Very difficult, but like it was incredible because I was hearing all these stories from so many different people, connecting with Mecca graduates from the 90s or 80s, or someone from South Africa wants me to get on a call with their students. Because like, they're like, it's different, but are similar. Like, your story tells exactly what it's like for our kids who are in these all white schools and in Johannesburg, or, you know, just people from everywhere talking to me all the time. And it's really, you know, humbled me and grown me. And it's been really awesome to watch my perspective grow, because, you know, I titled it Reflections from a Token Black Friend, because like it was really me reflecting and like writing it for myself more than anything, you know, like so I could look back on my experience, see how my perspective has changed and grown. And you know, I certainly experienced things growing up and through high school, and now I'm getting back to your original question, and things that would go like, I was always a guy who, because I was so immersed in the community, would easily dismiss or shrug off instances that I think for some of my peers in the program were really difficult for them to let go of, and it really hurt them and harmed their experience. And because of that, because I had like a group of loving, very genuine relationships with some white people and their parents especially, like it was easy for me to let things slide or see things for what they are, but not really give them the weight that they were probably due. And like, I came to college, and then there was all this work being done by the Globe at the time, actually, on like the racism in Boston. I read all their work, and I was like, wow, a lot of this actually makes sense, because like I'm always hanging in these like white parts of Boston, because it was the first time I really realized like, whoa, West Boston is like so segregated. Like, there's a black neighborhood, there's a black neighborhood, and then there's white neighborhoods. And people will be like, you don't have the Boston accent. And then I'm like, well, that's really only in the white part of Boston. Like, right. And like, I realized that, and I realized I would be out in these places like Cisco Brewery in Boston and like be one of four black people there. And like, some people would give me weird looks or be surprised if I want to talk to them or like, what's he doing? Or when I'm in like parts of South Bend and I realize like the deep racial tension history there. And I'm like, well, now it kind of makes sense when I get kind of oddly treated in some like bars or when I'm trying to like get in somewhere. Like, and then when that started to click for me and then I got to like the systemic levels of like, number one, it's been 40, 50 years while Mecca Hoop's been around. Why is that still a program? Like, like, why would there be a need for this program? And like, why are the schools honestly in the city probably in worse condition than they were then, you know? And then doubling down, like, again, I always realized it was rare that my family was by no means like a wealthy family. Like, we had to struggle for things and my parents could never buy us all the things we wanted. But like, by all means, it was a lot easier for me to fit into Weston and do things with my Weston friends than some of my other friends in the MECO program who like needed to work after school or take care of their siblings or had a single parent household. And then I'm realizing like, whoa, like in that Boston Globe piece, it's like around the number, it's like only 4% of the black families in Boston belong to the middle class, which is like a crazy number if you're calling it middle class. You know, it should be more like 30 to 40%.
Yeah.
And me realizing that, I was like, well, that explains a lot of the differences in my story and actually helps me understand a lot how I'll meet friends from the South who've been to Boston or like, it's a big thing in sports athletes, black athletes talking about how they hate playing, like visiting and playing Boston because they're like, I've never experienced more racist fans in my life.
Right.
And all this stuff was like new for me when I was first getting into school and facing these issues, but then it sort of started to grow and me starting to realize it a lot, especially as I got friends who were from such different parts of the country, whether that was my white friends from the Midwest and the South or like specifically my black friends who grew up in the South and in Georgia and in South Carolina and in Alabama, Mississippi. And they're like, dude, like where I'm from, you do not interact with the white people. Like, the white people, a lot of them make like you would feel like they hate you. Our communities are like the tension is like obvious and clear, and like it being really hard for them to come and for the first time in their lives be the only black kid in the classroom or the only black kid in the friend group or on a football team because we played lightweight football, which unlike maybe any football team country is like majority white. Maybe you only get that in like the NESCAC schools. And like that experience and watching that change and like us come from two different perspectives and like come to the sort of this middle ground where like now I recognize some of these issues and see them for what they are. But then my friend on the other side who is so polar opposite from my comfortability with white people. Watch that perspective come closer. Like, well, now I see I can have genuine relationships with these people. And like, there's still going to be a lot of instances of like microaggressions or stuff that's painful. But like, as we build a real relationship, we can actually talk about these issues. And like, I even enlightened some of my friends down South to be like, you know, like they're not all bad, man. Like there's bad ones. And like, there's people who are raised wrong, but it's more often than not, they're just raised wrong. And like, there's a place where they can grow. And, you know, that was what the transition was like when I was going through high school, because my perspective, like I've had some other MECO students say like they enjoyed reading my piece, but like I don't agree with it because, you know, you had a really positive experience in MECO, but I can name 10 people like me who hated it and who really would look back and wish they didn't have to go through these like painful experiences when they were like 12 years old.
Right.
Yeah. And me starting to understand that more, and me also, I come from like a really, it relates to like the type of personality I am and like things I'm choosing to do in my life. Like certain things I see as like, well, you still were given an amazing opportunity. And even if it wasn't always great for you, like you can't deny the fact that it was beneficial to you.
Mm-hmm.
And like where you are in life and what academic opportunities you've had and connections you've been able to build or the teams that you were able to be on and the funding they were able to have that then made you a better athlete.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's the perspective I tend to take on a lot of things. So
right.
For that reason, it contributes to why I easily, my nature sometimes is I too easily discount some of the negative experiences.
Right.
Because I overwhelmingly focus on the fact that like I was just blessed to have this compared to like my neighbors.
Right.
Or like who I played basketball with as a kid or little league with as a kid, knowing that they would have like killed for those opportunities.
Right. Right. And they might see it as, not to speak for them, but like, why can't we all have those opportunities? Like you shouldn't have to go through painful experience or be blessed to have it. Like we just should have had the same base level and we didn't.
Mm-hmm.
In Boston, I mean, so you were used to being the only Black person with a ton of white people, and then your friends in the South were not, because their schools were, they went to all Black schools and this, but I feel like segregation is still just so prominent in both places. It just plays out really differently.
Really differently.
And what do you and your friends have to say about that? What did you learn about talking to your friends from Alabama, and what did they learn from you, I guess?
Well, I think it's like when you boil it down to the soup and nuts, like it's the same thing.
Right.
It's just one community has had a narrative that allows them to give a facade that's not there.
Yeah.
And the other one has a narrative where like, well, you're from the South, which you admittedly like Civil War and like how that then perpetuates and like Jim Crow, the focus is always in the South.
Yeah.
And like the narrative is way different and more obvious. And because of that, like racism is permitted to be more obvious by people who like celebrate it. Like, people more comfortable with it, number one. And then on the flip side, like the experiences were so much more painful and open for the people who were, you know, disenfranchised, that the feelings of like bitterness and fear and sadness are way more on display as well. So like that passes itself down in how you raise your kids and the attitudes that they have.
Right.
So like, we don't talk about that, like in the North, go way back, like there was still slavery in the North, and like,
oh yeah,
Emancipation Proclamation only actually freed the slaves in the South, not in the North. Like, or like Jim Crow was a huge thing up here, or like I'm in Annapolis, and like, which is in like a really funky place because it's like, it was the South, but it was the North, and like,
right.
They stayed, but like Annapolis was one of the biggest slave ports. I think it was the biggest slave ports on the East Coast. Like,
wow.
Like things we don't talk about that here. Like how downtown Annapolis, where I just was, is so pretty and awesome and beautiful and boating. But like 30 years ago, 40 years ago, it was predominantly Black, and then it was like heavily gentrified. And now you only see the Black people in another part of Annapolis.
Right.
Like,
and we don't talk about
like things like that we don't talk about. Like,
yep.
In Boston, how like racism was a huge thing. And when integration happened, it's easy to think of like the Little Rock Nine or Ruby Bridges and all that occurring in the South. But like my mom rode on buses where they were throwing rocks at the, like parents were throwing rocks at the buses. And like, that's one generation removed, you know?
Right. That's not that long ago.
But we don't talk about that. And,
no,
it's all just very covert in Boston because we're a liberal hub. Like we're liberal on everything. And we talk about issues. But like, it doesn't mean that we always have addressed them, you know?
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I've lived in Boston for 2 years now, and that just like, it's so pervasive, and like, it just isn't talked about at all. I mean, and I will never experience that feeling, but it is just so crazy when you walk into a bar and I look around and everyone looks exactly like me, except for five people. That's
and like I think it speaks, I think Boston, if anything, speaks perfectly to sort of like the new age racism that people like is the hot topic now.
Yep.
Where like You honestly do not see a lot in my perspective, comparably, like if you're weighing both, like the systemic racism that's obviously on display is everywhere if your eyes are open to it.
Yes.
Like it's everywhere. Like I'm from Dudley Square, which is now Nubian Square. Like they renamed it for that like to recognize that it was like a historically black area. Mm-hmm. But like watching the gentrification occur there has been crazy. Like I remember in like when I was like a freshman in high school, if you saw a white person like walking down the street, it was the weirdest thing ever. And now half my neighbors are white, which is like fine with me. Like okay. I have nothing against those people. Like a lot of them are students or like young professionals, and a lot of them are nice neighbors. But like it speaks exactly to like there are people who I knew owned businesses in that area for like 50 years through their family, and like they're closed now, and they're something else. They're like a checks cashing or something,
right?
Things like that, and recognizing that like this in Boston, it's not growing together.
No, like, it's pushing people further to the edges.
It's growing in a great way, but like, good luck finding any black people in the new improved Seaport or in what's happening in Southie right now, where it's becoming amazing. Like, you know, it's sad, especially for a guy like me, whose perspective, like I said, is so much different because it's so rare that I'm from the middle class, mm-hmm. and my family won't ever have to worry about losing our house there. Like,
right.
Knock on wood, like it would take something very drastic for even things to go like crazy for us to lose our place there. Like,
right.
But, you know, I see the community change. Like for specifically where I live, it's like so many Somali families who like were originally refugees, and like mm-hmm. watching them sort of be pushed closer and closer away in their radius from like there's a mosque there, so that's why a lot of them chose to live there.
Okay.
And like just watching something like that occur where like they're not even what I would consider like what you typically think of in terms of how race plays itself out. Like you tend to like think of people from Africa as separate, but like it's the same thing occurring of like,
yep.
Just minority areas of Boston.
Right. And where, I mean, for like the community members whose businesses have been closed, where are they going? Just further away from the city or?
I mean, I think a lot of them are, you know, either, you know, selling whatever property they had.
Yeah.
And then maybe they're in a place where, you know, I hope it ended up all right.
Yeah.
But like the most notable one that if you asked anyone who grew up around Dudley is Nubian Notion.
Yeah.
Like it was just a corner store. It's like really all it was. And they sold like some clothes in the back and different things like that. But like, it's really just a corner store, but like everyone knows Nubian Notion if you're from that area, and it's gone, you know, like the building was redone, and the building is beautiful now. And that part is really awesome. They're redoing the library. The police station's beautiful. Like the building that behind it is the Teachers Union of Boston. It's really pretty. But that store's gone. And then there's stores in the bottom of where they redid the Teachers Union, like that were there for a long time that are gone, you know. It's disheartening.
It is disheartening. It's very disheartening. I was listening to a conversation with Ibram X. Kendi, and someone asked, you know, what do you think we should do about gentrification and like, but also wanting to, you know, white people wanting to live in areas to, you know, make the school system better, to have your taxes contribute to the school system, but not be forcing black people or, you know, BIPOC people out of those communities. Like, what is the solution to that, to this? Mm-hmm. And I don't think we have an answer yet, but I don't know. As a political science major, it's all policy. So
also it's such a complicated conversation because, you know, I've had that gentrification conversation with a good amount of people, including like, for instance, my buddy who's a state representative in Massachusetts, or one of my neighbors who's like very deeply involved with community work and politics. And like, he was like, hey man, like, Boston has tried, and they can do better, obviously, but like in certain aspects of gentrification has tried to do better. Like they give preferential leases or preferential auctions for people who have lived in the community before.
Mm.
Or if you're a Black family, they do programs with lotteries and stuff like that where you can get into these communities and be there. And it would hopefully match whatever means you have.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, a lot of Black people just don't take advantage of them, you know? And then that gets to a really complicated aspect, because it's like, part of that is built on itself. Like, if Black people are already unaware of these opportunities and there's already a prevailing narrative of what's happening and you don't think there's any way you can fight it,
mm-hmm.
you might not know to be looking for these opportunities to fight it.
Right.
Or know that you can do these programs or you can do this. And like, then it's kind of on the city to publicize it better and make sure that people are getting into these communities and like initiate programs that like look at someone who lives there and fits the profile and like directly tells them like, hey, you can do this.
Right.
Like, but then on the other side, like, you do have to have some sort of, you know, like, it's on us. We need to start being better about holding on tightly to our communities and supporting our businesses. Because, you know, if, for instance, and I can't say specifically what happened with Nubian Ocean, but what if everyone in the community around was just like, on April 14th, we're all buying something from there.
Right.
Which could result in a crazy amount of money that could last a long time for them. Or like,
yeah,
just something like that. Like every Monday, which is always like a thing people try to start, like Black Owned Friday or something like that, like do something like that, or my own Minority Owned Monday. But like, if we would actually put our money where our mouth is,
right,
a lot of things we could fight on our own. And like, that's where you get to the really complicated debates of like, there's a part of it that's on us as a community, and then there's a part of it that's just on the system.
Yeah.
And like, there is a power disparity there in terms of how much more easily the system can affect immediate change versus the community itself.
Right. And also, I guess there's a piece of the system. You need to believe that your voice matters and that you have purchasing power. And when a system tells you that you don't, it's really hard to feel like, no, actually I do. And we can do this. It's just, again, like a vicious cycle.
That plays on itself.
Yeah. Yeah. So then, if you don't mind talking a bit more about Indianapolis and the Naval Academy, and I mean, you're all in this system together, which seems incredibly demanding and intense, but everyone comes from a different background, as you've been saying, and sort of navigating that and facing racism there. And yeah,
it's really unique because, you know, it's a federally funded school.
Mm-hmm. Completely.
So everyone, you get someone from every single part of the country, like every congressional district, and you get people from all over the world and like who are our allies and there. So it's like the community is so cool, because I'm so thankful that I didn't just go to, you know, like play D3 football at an SCAC school and like mostly only see Northeasterners, you know, or go down to like, even if you went to like a UVA or something, like majority of the kids are just from Virginia and then from like Jersey. Like, yeah, that's really where a lot of them come from, and their families worked in,
very correct.
It's like Jersey and West, you know, or like if you go a little deeper, it's like everybody's from Westchester and Darien, Connecticut, you know? So I'm really thankful that I got the experience of meeting, like having a best friend from suburbs of Chicago, then a best friend from Georgia, then a roommate from Albany, Georgia, and then another roommate from San Diego, and another roommate from Colorado Springs, like really cool, or a best friend from Tennessee, like really unique attitudes. And like, I'm coming from hyper liberal Boston, and like, I'm hearing friends say things that I haven't heard said in years, because we just don't say those things in Boston. Like, you would be destroyed by someone if they heard you say like this joke or something.
Yeah.
And like, me coming from this perspective was like, okay, now I have to like gear myself to like help friends along in this area. But there's also like, I also learned another perspective of like, I now understand when I hear the narrative of like, it's not that serious, man. Like, I get where it comes from now, because like, I've met very, very good people who at the same time may perpetrate some of these things that like I've been raised to think of as like you just don't do ever.
Right.
You know, I could take this really like assaulting view on it and like, mm-hmm. well, these people shouldn't be my friends then. Mm-hmm. But like, I don't think that's productive at all. And I think it doesn't recognize that like, we're just from two different communities, you know? And
right.
the same way if I met someone from like an Islamic nation in the Middle East, they're probably going to have some things they say about women that I just vehemently disagree with, but like, doesn't mean we can't grow together to like change those attitudes. And like, I'll probably learn something too about why his culture functions that way.
Right. You know? Instead of shutting down that conversation before.
I think a lot of, I think the narrative that prevails in Boston and just sort of liberal politics in general, I think can get to that point because mm-hmm. a lot of these issues are so emotionally based and like they provoke a lot of anger and frustration mm-hmm. and they've been around for so long that it's like, we're just like, people need to figure this out. Like,
yeah.
why is the women's movement 60 years long, you know? Like, why is the civil rights movement, if you really want to like be honest, why is it 300 years long, you know? So like, I get those feelings, but at the same time, like I grew a lot by just learning how to be a more accepting person mm-hmm. and recognizing of like, see people for their values and not always like the reflection of the way they've been raised. Or like, can I really, going into race, like it does no good for me to refuse to be friends with this white friend who says out of pocket things, but it, other than that has always been loving to me, mm-hmm. but grew up in a town where I was the first black person he ever met now. Like it does no good to him or to a cause I believe in mm-hmm. to not have like the resilience in my perspective.
Yeah.
Determination to like want to grow that relationship
right.
because like for me the most difficult person to work with and to talk about these issues with is a common person who I'm around because of the sphere I'm in, which is like this very strong-willed, excellent value set, hard-working person who sees people for he judges them alone on their value set and how they treat people and how hard of a worker they are mm-hmm. and sees nothing else. Mm-hmm. I don't, and like the class design is like, I don't care if you're black, brown, blue, yellow, or red, like as long as you're a good person, which like is a great perspective and starting point, mm-hmm. but like it needs to go a step further to recognize like there's going to be differences in everyone's story. And like in the same way I should judge a coworker for if it's a female, like for how hard she works and her value set and how she treats people and how she engages with the company, I should also be recognizing and considerate of the fact that like, maybe there's things that she'll do that are just a reflection because it's uncomfortable to be a woman in a male dominated organization. Or like there's mm-hmm. things that men project onto her that I'm only projecting because like I'm socialized that way. And that's not actually what's happening. Like she might be doing the exact same thing I would do, but I'm pre-biased to feel a different way. And I think taking that step along in anything, whether it's race or gender mm-hmm. or dealing with people from the LGBT community, like taking that step extra is like very difficult to communicate to people who feel like and actively exhibit that they only judge people off their value set and the type of person they are, but aren't realizing that like there's a lot of subconscious and implicit things going on that they might not be aware of.
Right.
Which is why like one of the hardest things to talk about implicit bias with people is like people don't understand the word implicit. It's like it's like that means you don't know what's happening. Like like
you have no idea it's like, that it's just like right there.
You're trying to describe it to someone or it's trying to be described to me on something I do. And my reaction is to say like, well, I was thinking this or I was doing this, like yeah, that's the exact point. Like you don't realize that it's happening, you know, and you don't know that there's something informing what you're saying that you haven't considered, which is why it's implicit, you know. Right. Like explicit bias is really easy to discuss because it's like you can call it out for what it is and like
have a conversation.
And I think that's an area where people have frankly in our time been trying to grow so much mm-hmm. and it's where that attitude comes from mm-hmm. and I think for people, for instance, like, I think LGBTQ issues are really easy to see this one in, because like a lot of people still have a lot of reservations with those issues. Mm-hmm. But I think what's becoming a more dominating view, especially within conservative groups, is like a, you just do you, and if it doesn't affect me and you're not hurting anyone, like, more power to you, you know?
Right.
Which is kind of just a reflection of like, I'm not going to explicitly ever be biased towards these people, because I realized that was the view for a while, and I see how that was wrong. And like, people who 20 years ago or even 10 years ago would have one view on like when they see the Supreme Court make a certain decision in favor of gay rights, mm-hmm. has a different one now, because they're like, well, yeah, you know, a business shouldn't be able to turn you away just because you're gay.
Right,
like,
right.
Now they're like, well, explicit bias is obviously wrong, you know, like, and now there's this view of like, well, just let's just each do our thing and operate independently. And like, and I think that's a reflection of like the type of growth we've made in explicit bias, where I think we have done really well of making people feel uncomfortable with that. And obviously there's so many levers that say the opposite of like certain things with our administration and, mm-hmm. and that are out there that have made some people more outright and outspoken about things like mm-hmm. that. But I think overall the narrative with explicit bias has been like, it will be positive. And I think the history trend line will show positive growth in that area. But implicit bias becomes really hard to talk about, because it's like a man in the mirror type of thing.
Yeah.
And it's also like, we're all guilty of it.
Right.
In something. And you get into like the hypocrites debate, where like, you can either take this as like, hey man, this is something I struggle with too, so this is why I want to help you with it and you can help me with it. Mm-hmm. Or you can take it as like, why are you talking to me, man? You do that too.
Yeah.
And it's like two paths.
Yeah. And
conversation, I feel like, productive or not.
Right. And it seems like right now what we're trying to work through, or like a lot of novels that are being encouraged, are to get through that, hey, don't call me out because you do it too. And more of like, okay, yeah, like we're working on this together. Like, I need to check why I reacted that way or felt that way. But it's way harder to like point your finger at you than it is to like, oh, that person said that and that was wrong, versus mm-hmm. like, oh, I thought that way, why? Mm-hmm. Like, what's up with that?
Yeah. And it's all so personal, which makes it even harder.
Yeah.
You know, because like, for instance, I think so many of these solutions people agree with when it's on the grand scale and when it's theoretical or not impacting you, but it's when it enters like the sphere of your life and you feel like you've been a good person,
yeah,
that you're like, now this is really hard.
Yeah.
Like, for instance, like something that's always been a hot topic, affirmative action. In theory, majority of people would probably agree that like, to right the wrongs of the past, you probably need to do some things to equal the playing field before you can transition to just equal policies, where right. like weighing objectively.
Right.
But then as soon as it's your daughter or your son that's not getting into school, like, you really latch onto that argument of like, well, she only got in because she's Black.
Yes.
My daughter.
Blame someone else.
Like, especially if you have a son who's cisgender and it's straight, like, and fits the mold of the demon. Like, you're like, well, how is he supposed to get into Harvard? He's freaking white male, straight athlete. Like,
yeah.
and like, I sympathize with that argument. It's just like, we need people to step a little deeper than that and understand, like,
right.
to treat it instead as like, it's your honor. You should think of it as like, wow, it's my honor that I can like positively impact this issue through a decision I make in my personal life. Like,
right.
A lot of times it's just on the system and what policies are out there which guide like interest rates or things like that. Like, but here's one where, like, because I know this is important and because I know these issues still affect people,
mm-hmm.
my son's gonna be all right either way.
Yeah.
And maybe he was that one or two people that were on the crux with another person and the difference was the gender or the race.
Yeah.
But like, can you take a step back and look at how you just made a positive change that's right. going to help everyone eventually? because maybe he ends up having a daughter or marrying someone who's Black and having a kid who has to face these issues, or he has a best friend who's positively impacted him and is of a different race. Mm-hmm. And like, you're helping that community, which in turn is helping you.
Right.
And I think it's, you can step back and see that that's when something where we can get past a lot of what I would call is in the weeds in terms of keeping us from getting any further.
Right. Right. Instead of reacting with like, you know, that anger, this is so unfair, more of like, yeah, the woe is me, you know, I'm the victim, that moving on and just, you know, knowing that, especially for if you have a white child, like, it might not be Harvard, but they'll get into another school and they really just, they will be okay. Mm-hmm. And hopefully by allowing someone else to be more okay than they maybe would have been because they don't have the same opportunities granted, like, we're all moving up together.
Yeah. And like, I think it's, I thought this was an original thought when I shared it, but I think it actually comes from Ibram X. Kendi because someone was reading his book and mentioned it to me, which is like his response to the colorblind society view, which like, and I thought of this, you know, through my conversations with the people, and I see now how it's like, he's a brilliant mind. So I'm like, it's a substantive thing, which is you can't go from a color-focused society and then just snap and make it a colorblind society without spending some sort of period in between to correct for the issues of the of color-focused society. Because if you go snap into the other one, then those inequalities just continue to perpetuate themselves, which is exactly where we are. Because like, for the most part, you know, a lot of the explicit straight like stuff within our system is gone, you know, like we're not in segregated schools. Mm-hmm. You can't make me a slave, but like there's nuanced stuff in there that is perpetuating itself from the color focused society, which is like, I try to tell people, I was on another podcast with this guy, we're like, you would have to be so naive to think that when segregation ended via Brown v. Board of Education, that all these school administrators were just like, all right, yeah, let's just like make this work, you know, like, yeah, let's get all the kids in here, you know, we'll work together. Like, no, they definitely did like subtle things within the system to make sure that it maintained itself.
Not even that subtle.
Yeah. And some of it's so overt, but like, for someone who's like, it's harder for them to latch onto this argument, like, do you think they wouldn't do everything or at least some of the things possible to ensure the system maintained itself?
Right.
And like, if you can begin to accept that, like, you can understand why there's a need for whatever reparations look like. And to me, it doesn't look like a check in the pocket of someone, but like, it looks like something.
Right.
Like, and if you could actually, like, Ta-Nehisi Coates, I think, was the one speaking to the Senate about it and gave like the most beautiful, brilliant argument for why you need reparations. But like, if you struggle, like, just think about that, and that you can, it'll even let you remove it from yourself, because that might be really hard to do, to understand where you play a role. Like,
right.
But you just look at that and then see the system is still flawed.
Right. I think Ta-Nehisi Coates addressed the Senate, and he, I'm pretty sure it's him, wrote this article for The Atlantic, if I'm remembering correctly.
Case for reparations. Yeah.
I mean, he's just brilliant, but it's so well worded. Just like, an America, I think he said this, I'm paraphrasing, an America that acknowledges its, you know, its past and apologizes for it is way better than this America right now that isn't really saying anything. And if we're starting to, but like, not even an apology, come on. The bare minimum is an apology.
If you talk about these issues or these feats, you have to talk about these low points in our history too. I think we sometimes forget how much we've been propagandized and misled into how we believe things, which is like, when I talk to some of my Southern friends who like love the Confederate flag and have been, you know, for to use a harsh word, like brainwashed into thinking that the Civil War was not about slavery, or like carrying the flag now is only about Southern pride, which is just being proud of the state you're from. Like, they've just been inundated with that narrative that is false. But, and like, I could show you a descriptive history of why that's propaganda, of like who was doing it. And like, we know all these things, or like why our textbooks were different. Like, and I could tell you the organization that made it that way. Like, when we can start to realize those things, and it goes into so many other issues too, but mm-hmm. and just thinking more deeply as like a thoughtful citizen.
Yeah. Yes. I agree. Thinking more deeply, like on a day to day, being more present in the actions and like what you perpetuate is such an important next step. At the end of your Medium article, you were saying something your uncle said to you. And I don't want to botch it, but
when the dust settles, I wonder if anything will ever change.
Yeah.
And I said, I would rephrase it to make it a personal question of when the dust settles, I wonder if I will have actually changed.
So it's been like 6 weeks since you wrote that article. I feel like there was like a big wave of support for Black Lives Matter, for Defund the Police, lots of social media presence. And now at least I feel like it's sort of settling, unfortunately. The dust has settled. So what do you think? I mean,
I've talked to people about that, and I think you have to realize, like, be real, because that's the nature of anything in any movement, where they go through periods of high awareness and high steam, and they slow, and something else happens, mm-hmm. and they pick up again. You know, I think it's like a complicated snowballing effect where like the snowballing's happening and then it like levels and then it happens again. Like, mm-hmm. but it is getting bigger every time. And I think if that's not clear through what just happened just now, like think about Michael Brown and how it seemed big, and then look at now, like right. this puts that to make it look like it was just us, you know, holding up a sign like for a day. And while I think the social media aspect and what you're seeing has dulled a little bit, and obviously like there's other important things too, like the virus is important to be talking about, and like
certainly
other things like that, or like anti-Semitism I think is a hot topic right now, really important.
Yeah.
But I personally have felt that the thinking about it is still active. It's not mm-hmm. as active, but I still think it's above the baseline by a landslide from what it was before. Because yeah. I'll still, and obviously it's a little different with me because people read my piece and maybe they'll see me for the first time since and they want to talk about it. But like,
yeah.
I'm still witnessing these conversations all the time. Or like, I was inside the kitchen talking to my buddy sponsor mom about the article because she read it, and like, she's a writer, so she really had a lot of thoughts with me.
Mm.
And then I walked outside to rejoin my friends, and they were talking about race, completely disconnected from me being there or our conversation inside. Yeah. And they were just talking about race. Or the other night I'm over and I wasn't participating in the conversation at all, and my friends were just around a table talking about race and gender and all these different things, and like how our society can be better, and the different perspectives, which really relate to what I was talking about, like the hardworking person idea of like the view that they project, and then like the one who's like more empathetic and considering aspects bigger than yourself, like
yeah.
watching that play out. And I was just sitting there watching the whole time. I said like three sentences the whole conversation. Like
yeah.
I'm seeing that occur on a way higher scale.
Yes.
And there's always going to be fatigue with anything. It's like when a friend dies, mm-hmm. for that first month or two, everybody's still calling the family and talking to them, and you know, yeah. putting stuff on their story and all these great things of support, but like that fades pretty slowly at first, but then quickly after. And then there's still a large group of people though, I think, that like care and are still talking about it, and it's still a discussion point, and
mm-hmm.
and trying to do what they can for that family.
Mm-hmm.
And like, if something ever happened again, like it picks up again and it comes probably even stronger than it did at first.
Right.
And like, that's an abstract comparison, but I think if you compare it to this, like the effect is still there. Yeah. You'll still grieve every time you think of that friend that passed away, like the emotional response will come back. So now, related to the movement, like all that's out there now, and that awakening has started for a lot of people, I think more so than ever I've seen, and I think my mom would say, you know, since she's seen since the 60s,
right.
Like for 50 years, she has never seen the awakening occur that hard.
Yeah.
And I think now whenever these issues come up, and it really just takes one person around the table, like lighting the match, now people have a lot of views on it and a lot of thoughts and a lot of things they want to share, and a lot of, like, everyone has a perspective now. It's not something you can just not have a perspective on, and that's cool. Like, you know, like, if you don't have a view on, like, Black Lives Matter, like,
you're not paying attention.
Wow, dude, like, you're just kind of a clown right now.
Yeah.
Which I think is a positive societal step. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that we're fixing everything or on the path of, like, hard charging movement still, but, like, we made a major step in consciousness.
Yeah. Do your parents feel hopeful because they have seen, you know, these little sparks every 5 to 10 years, but they haven't really seen a fire get lit?
Yeah.
How do they feel?
It's very different for me because my dad is Indian Malay.
Yeah.
So he feels very, like, he doesn't have, like, these deep responses to these issues, deep responses, but, like, he stays in tune with the news, like, regardless of what's going on.
Sure.
So, like, he's kind of one of those people who it's, like, difficult to talk to about these issues because he holds that view of, like, you're a product of your choices.
Right.
But he's also recognizing of, like, things that affect us and affect him because he's brown skinned, like,
mm-hmm.
He's 100% aware of that. And, like, he's Indian. So, like, the caste system, like, he understands these issues
totally
well, but, like, he doesn't comment on them a lot because a lot of them, he's just like, some people are stupid and some people are not. Like, there's some stupid people with some stupid views. And then there's a lot more people who are just better people and want to grow, you know?
Right.
So, like, doesn't ever, it tends to not go much deeper than that.
Yeah.
But, you know, my mom is like, it's a combination of both. Like, one hand, she's like, you know, this is beautiful to see. And, like, I love seeing my sons become active in this and my daughter, like, it's awesome. And, like, our friends, and she's been touched positively by all the white relationships that we have. Like, she definitely laid that foreground for us and that mm-hmm. foundation, but, like, our parents being friends with her, our friends being people that she calls, like, her sons and her daughters, like, her extra family, like, really positive factors. But, you know, at the same time, she's like, why are my sons still dealing with this same issue that I saw when I was a kid? You know, like,
exhausting.
Why is there rioting and looting? And there was rioting and looting in the 90s, and there was rioting and looting in the 70s, and there was rioting and looting in the 50s and 60s. Like,
yeah.
Why is this still? So in that aspect, like, I think the hope struggles, but then she sees it a lot through, like, half the marches in Boston that occurred started 100 feet down my street in Dudley Square, and that's where they would start the base. Like, it's cool to see, you know, or, like, yeah. The flags or the painting, the Black Lives Matter thing, like, initials, like, so it's a complex view, but I think there is a spark of hope,
yeah,
for a lot of people in that generation.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I think a lot of movements are carried by the younger people, so.
Totally. Absolutely. Yeah, I think we see that throughout history, and it's just on us to keep going.
Like, I just finished Hamilton yesterday. He was 19 when he started. Like, that's pretty crazy.
So crazy.
Yeah.
Oh, Hamilton's so good. I know we only have a little bit more time, and I don't know if you want to answer this question, but I have a question. You're part of the military, the Navy. What is your attitude towards the kind of defund the police movement and just, like, moving forward? And I know the military and the police are different. However, you know, you're all civil servants supposed to protect society. Mm-hmm. At a march in Boston, you know, there was military personnel who were deployed to be there. Like, it just, you know, it's intertwined. I don't know that much about it, but I just wonder if you have a thought on it.
So, very similar organizations in some ways in terms of how they function and chain of command and things like that, and mm-hmm. obviously violence oriented or mm-hmm. connected, violence connected,
sure.
but, like, very, very different in I think, a lot more ways than the average citizen can see, who's not plugged into either, because like military has like strict structures in place that, you know, mitigate issues, and the public trust is probably like the most forefront aspect of decision making in the higher leadership position, because it's all connected, and like nothing can occur if the public trust goes away.
Yeah.
And like there's scandals all the time, but like they become scandals because of that. Like,
right.
Because the public trust is important and the betrayal is very painful and off. And just like being civilian run, like the number one person in the military is the president, who's a civilian. Right. After that, it's the Secretary of Defense, who's a civilian.
Right.
After that, in the Navy and the Marine Corps, it's the Secretary of the Navy, who's a civilian. And then it's a military person.
True.
You know, like there's four people ahead, and you could count like senators on the Armed Forces Committee and the Secretary of State, like people in there who are just like all above us, NSA direct, like, and that aspect of it, like, for instance, like one of my friends who fits like perfectly the idea of what I've been trying to, I've gone back to again and again, on like the people I find hardest to talk about this, like done a ton of research into all of this. And he's like, when it comes to police, like this is primarily about training and the organizational structure of police systems. Like, for instance, many, many communities where you see a majority of these issues, like he's from Chicago, I'm from Boston, like doesn't function the way a lot of communities do with the way the sheriff's department works, where like the sheriff is an elected individual by the people who oversees the entire police department and his sheriff's department. And if you don't like what's going on, you don't elect that sheriff. But like in Boston, the sheriff is very disconnected from Boston Police Department or Chicago Police Department or NYPD or LAPD. Like you elect your sheriff, but you probably don't know who your sheriff is. Like,
no.
I didn't know who my sheriff was until yesterday when I looked it up. And like, that's just an organizational choice that has like huge impacts in terms of like police feeling less accountable to the people.
Right.
And more accountable to like the district attorney and the judges, like
who have
a complicated relationship because they have to work together to get the right people off the streets. But then when you have like someone within it who's messing up bad, nothing's happening. And like he was going over the statistics of like, it's something like 80% of the police you see in these big situations of like serious things where like they've killed someone unjustly or brutality, like they've been reported in the past.
Right.
And then within that, a majority of the reports are from fellow police officers who are like, I was out on a patrol with this guy and he did something fucked up. And like they reported it, but then nothing happened. And then there was a huge thing that happened.
Right.
And like, if that doesn't speak to the fact that there's like an organizational setup problem and structural problem to what's going on, on top of like, obviously there's so many bad apples, and maybe it's even unfair to say bad apples because the prevalence might be bigger.
Yeah.
But like the overwhelming aspect of like the system being the problem is because the system is designed so poorly in training. And like, for instance, most police officers get one psych eval in their whole career, and it's right when they come in.
Whoa.
Whereas like you would never take a deployed military officer or enlisted and bring him back. There's a psych eval every time they come back from deployment.
Sure.
And you would never keep them perpetually on deployment because you know what it does to the human psyche. Right. And they'll like, for instance, be on a patrol in Iraq and this guy's not doing anything, but he's been there for so long that he just kills him because he just thinks of all Iraqis as bad.
Right.
Like there's books about that where like there was a very famous army unit that was deployed for way too long. And these guys just went crazy.
Right.
And raped a bunch of women and children and killed them. And like, it's a terrible, sad, awful story. And like a complete blot on like the military's record, but like speaks exactly like to like the psychological effects of these sort of high intensity, potentially in some cases, like very dangerous, traumatic jobs. And like our police some of them in these communities are going through things all the time, and we just like don't treat it like the ticking time bomb it can be if you're not making sure these guys are okay and that they're heavily supervised. And like, if someone is reported on something, like you treat it like in the military, like the Chief Gallagher situation that became a really big deal in the SEAL thing.
Yep.
It was a really big deal because they're so heavily supervised.
Right.
And like, if this stuff was going on, something wrong and corrupt must have been happening. That's what a lot of people felt, because like, if you're in that community, like I have buddies in that community, they're like, dude, we are so strict on each other about things we do. And like, you could literally know this person is planning to try to kill you tomorrow and their exact plan. And if it doesn't fit the rules of engagement and like the chain of command's approval and all these things, you can't do a thing. And we strictly hold ourselves to those standards. And like, what it seems more so is like, that's just not happening within the police communities.
Totally.
There is 1,000 things you can do between when you get to the window of someone's car and maybe they're like rattled or in a bad state, or and maybe even in this case, like maybe they're violent. There's a million things you can do in between if you're trained properly before taking your gun out, like to be able to mitigate a situation like that. And like, obviously there are some attitudes and like, you can't ignore the history of the police as starting as an organization to hunt slaves down. And like, knowing in communities where racism was prevalent, like the KKK placed people into the police because they knew they would have impunity. Like, you can't ignore those issues. But overwhelmingly, when I see defund the police, like the accurate part of it is like, yes, the system itself is just built completely wrong.
Totally.
And not considerate of like, there should be mental health professionals within the police community, or like there should be a community working arm that says like, I see people loitering. How can I get them to do something positive? Like, hey, I'm going to call Public Works and they're going to bring a bunch of shovels. You guys can make $15 an hour if you do this landscaping on this public sidewalk, or like clear this snow from in front of the City Hall building. Like, things like that, where like all that is missing. And that's where like defund the police is so accurate of like, it's morphed into this arm of like a local military where it's people it's protecting are also its enemies, which is like the complete wrong relationship to exist. It's supposed to be cooperative and like, just like, you need some law enforcement to a degree for like the violent, problematic people in society. But like, it operating as like a business to feed into prisons and to perpetuate systemic inequalities across race and across other things. Like, that's when it's a problem. Totally. And that's what needs to be redesigned.
Totally. I think your point is so interesting with the military. Like, it's just so highly regulated, and your leaders are the leaders that we all put into place. Like, it's just so. I think that's a really, really good point, and just leads to a level of accountability that's so high, because you're just held in such high esteem by your peers, your society, and you feel like, you're accountable to the people around you.
And no system is perfect. Like, the military definitely has its flaws, and like a lot of that relates to just how large it is. Like, you're going to have issues, but like in design, I believe it's far better at preventing these massive issues than a police department is set up.
Absolutely.
And how a police department engages with the community.
Yeah. Thank you for chatting for so long. This has just been the best conversation, and thanks for answering all my questions. I couldn't appreciate it more. It's been such a nice chat. Do you have anything else that's on your mind, or before we wrap up, anything else?
Maybe one thing, because this has kind of been a tidbit I've been hitting on in a lot of my conversations with individuals about like allyship and being an ally has kind of become like a hot term now, and maybe it's like it's numbed now and overused, but there's so much going around of like how to be a better ally and like how this person is being a terrible ally. And like, I think a lot of personally, like I see a lot of like white on white vilifying, which is like, there's a need for that to a degree, but like the one tidbit I like to share with people with like, and this is my view, like it looks different in every situation and every person. And my friend who's a social justice warrior in everything, when she's my ally, like she's going to call someone out for the, maybe to you might like a, to a third party might seem like a small thing, and she's going to give a really educated perspective on it and help that moment grow in a really powerful way. Yeah. And she's capable of like calling out her family when they say something wrong every single time, you know. But like my friend from middle of nowhere Ohio or Pennsylvania, like him being an ally to me is him, you know, like reached out to me and was just like, hey man, until I read your piece, I didn't realize that a lot of the jokes I make and things I say are wrong.
Yeah.
And like, and ill rooted. And like, you know, I'm a good guy and like, you know, my values and that like, I've always treated you with respect, but like, just know that I'm trying to be better about that. And I'm trying to learn more about this and whatever, like in my case, he's being the best ally that he can legitimately and reasonably be.
Sure.
And in another case, that looks like way, I want way more from them because I know they care about issues. So if I see them not caring about this issue right. as passionately as others, that's when I get a little upset, you know?
Totally.
So like the narrative, because I think a lot of people can feel really lost in how to do this right.
Yeah.
Like the truth is you're going to learn how to do it right by doing it wrong.
Right.
And it's that one time that you reach out to someone the wrong way or address an issue the wrong way, or really miss an opportunity to address something serious.
Yep.
Which is something I had, I was talking about the other day with something about like women in the military and something some officers said to a huge group of about to graduate officers and how I think they now changed for the worse their perspective on how to engage with their female counterparts. And like, I was thinking about it yesterday and I felt awful because I was like, I could have been courageous and called them out for it in the time, but like, in the moment, I was just not thinking of it the right way.
Right.
And like, for that reason, I'm going to be better about it in the future,
yes.
the next 10 times.
Yes.
So like, don't be afraid in these situations of messing up or doing the wrong thing. Cause like, obviously we live in the age of cancel culture and outrage culture, but like the courage you need to have is like, go with the feeling inside and put your heart on the line. And if you say the wrong thing or maybe do the wrong thing,
yeah.
your heart is out there. People should see that and you're going to do better about it in the future. And like, even if you're the best ally, you're going to mess up.
Totally. You can only be a better ally by messing
only
up.
Only mess up. By, until you mess up, you're not going to know how to do it better and how to engage with so many different people.
Yeah. No, I think that's incredibly, incredibly helpful advice. And a great perspective on just recognizing where people are and their different, how they can be their best selves in this movement. It looks really different from individual to individual. And it doesn't mean they're not trying if they're not, you know, Absolutely. Social justice warrior number one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.